Okay. So this is Emily Gallagher. It is June 5th, 2013 in Hudson, New York. And I am here with John Craig. John, would you like to introduce yourself?
Well, we are in the history room of the Hudson Area Library. It's a pleasure to be here with you on this occasion in this great room that the library is has been devoted to since its inception in 1959, our local history repository. And I'm the volunteer. I've been the volunteer for the last, I don't know, 3 or 4 years. What else can I say? History of Hudson is endlessly fascinating. I don't know why exactly, except, of course, it is. Goes far back. Goes back 220 years since the city was founded. And it's had a lot of tawdry, famous tawdry elements, and poverty through most of the 20th century, and gambling and prostitution, famous for those things, and it all makes for a remarkable wide range of endlessly fascinating historical explorations that are so inviting and just are so interesting. There are endless stories to be looked into. And a fair number of secrets, I think, that still are waiting to be told. There's a certain tight-lippedness about some of the details of things across time, I think. I became quickly curious about one thing or another. One thing led to another, local curiosities, which brought me quickly to the history room to begin that research. And as this room is only open on Saturday mornings, I couldn't possibly wait till Saturday. So I would come during the week, and the very kind assistant librarian would trudge up here and get 5 volumes of city directories and bring them down to me, and then I'd give her my next request. And this went on for a while, and finally she said, you know, if you volunteered to be the volunteer in the history room, you can go anytime you want to. And I thought, well, that sounds like a good idea. So it's my Saturday morning post and source of great amounts of information. Otherwise, particularly the Hudson City directories, which we have most every copy from 1852 when it started up through the present. And historically, those directories list everybody in town, where they work, and their occupation, and their wife's first name, and sometimes their children, and their address. And that's an astonishing place to start most anything, to figure out who people are and where they worked. And it's an unrivaled, it is a remarkable collection in and of itself. Up at the Columbia County Historical Society, I went to see what they might have on the directories, as we have many doubles, and I wanted to trade to fill in our gaps, and found, when they led me into the vault, literally, and opened the box of the city directories, they had 5. And we have probably 200. And of those 160 years, we probably have 130, 125 or 130 of those 160 years here. And I say the library, from the get-go in 1959, was completely devoted to having a history room to collect those things that would otherwise disappear.
Tell me about your relationship to history.
Well, I've always been fascinated with history. I wasn't a particularly good student, but history and English always appealed to me. From always, history. I came here 8 years ago looking for a place where I wouldn't know anybody, so I could immerse myself in finishing a couple of life's works, history projects. And just as that finished, is when I suddenly had some free time that was hit and miss, and that was just when my curiosity about things here, starting with baseball, because baseball is my main metaphor, and I wonder if they ever had a team, a professional team, and indeed they did. From 1903 to 1907, in a fascinating league called the Hudson River League, all the way down to Paterson, New Jersey, and Yonkers, and up and down the river. And for some reason, I then wondered, well, where were the movie theaters? You couldn't find anybody who knew the answer to that either. I thought, well, that needs to be known. So I started looking at the baseball, and that quickly led to the movies because the baseball players ended up being key parts of the development of film exhibition in Hudson. So, perfect. So that's been my main project for the last 4 years, is the history of the Hudson movie theaters, having done the history of the baseball team. And all of that is a truly epic story, which is still in process, but I hope next spring to give my first talk on the subject, and someday that collection of material will be in a form that can be distributed. So I've really been developing a little series. People that come and ask questions, simple questions on the street, they come up here. Not all of them are anything particularly interesting to me, but enough of them are that I will find myself a month later obsessively completing a 4 or 5 week immersion in research to answer the question, the simple question. A friend of mine last year said his grandfather had a bar down on the river in 1928. Could I find the name of the bar? The names of bars are proving to be impossible to find. They're never listed by name. There's an archive of photographs that had to be submitted in 1934 in the wake of Prohibition's repeal. Anybody who wanted to open a bar had to have photographs of their establishment. But all the photographs are unidentified. And a couple of the local city historian, Pat Fenoff, and another fellow who knows much, went through it, and they couldn't identify any of them. But that has led to a whole nother research project. That's the history of Ferry Street, where his grandfather's bar was, which is really where Hudson started on that path. That's now the ferry, known as the Ferry Street Bridge, where the ferry service used to be at its foot, and two ancient buildings stood across the bridge. And it's like that, just a simple question leads to remarkable discoveries and fascinating revelations. And speaking of oral histories, about 20 years ago, there were people here when oral history was becoming a kind of popular phenomenon in the country, who wanted to do that in Hudson. But nobody was interested. And some of them are still with us. And the moment is, this is really the 11th hour of starting this, and that you all have come, and all this interest in oral history is phenomenal, because there's still enough people left to get on tape. And that's big. That's really big.
So you said that, I just want to check and make sure this is okay, good. You said that you wanted to find a place to come to. What made you think of Hudson, and why did you choose Hudson?
Well, leaving New York, it's sort of like shooting a dart, throwing darts in the dark. And it seems uniquely a New York dynamic. If you're leaving there, you have to pick somewhere in the universe. It's a little overwhelming. Mm-hmm. I suppose it's true of everywhere, but somehow it seems more unique to New York. But I had been up here to visit, and it seemed like a nice enough place. I didn't really know the town. I didn't even realize there were other streets besides Warren Street. But I called my friends, said, if you hear of a place, maybe I'll move to Hudson. I was retired. And they called right back, and I came and looked at this apartment that was 5, 6, 7 rooms. And they opened the back door and said, these are your gardens. And me and the cat, leaving Elizabeth Street, thought, well, this looks about as close to heaven as one could ever dream. And it was for 4 years. And then everything changed. Everything turned upside down. And I was rolling down the proverbial hill on fire. And that's when I reinvented myself. I had a car that I had taken of my mother's just for a little while. And suddenly I needed to find a job, and I needed to sell the car. And 2 seconds after I burst into flames, the entire economy collapsed. So there were no jobs to be had. There were no cars to be sold. And 8 months later, someone hired me to be their driver twice a month, one of our famous local residents. And that was an exceptional opportunity if I could only think of some way to survive the other 28 days of the month. And that's when inadvertent entrepreneurship raised its possibilities in the form of my car to make the job I couldn't find. And I became a car service by word of mouth. But it has over 4 years proven to be a delight and a pleasure. And one nice person tells somebody else, oh, they know this guy, and it leads to others. And now it's a very viable service that enough interesting people are happy to partake of. So it's worked out very nicely. Hudson has the highest rate of self-employment of any place in New York State, a rate higher even than Los Angeles or San Francisco. So it is something of a self-inventive place. In related thought, my first week in Hudson, I was at a historic Hudson annual meeting, and I met a fellow named Frank Faulkner, who said to me, "You know, Hudson is like a college town for adults, and it's still the best description I think I've heard yet." And I think I've amended it to say it's really a graduate program, a self-editing graduate program, where we go back into our dorm rooms that might be 200-year-old houses, but we eventually come out for air and coffee, of which there's abundant supply, and run into each other, and it's all pretty damn remarkable. I have a friend who moved up from the city 2.5 years ago, and she seems a little perplexed about where she is and lives on Warren Street, and said to me recently, "You know, my favorite TV show used to be Twin Peaks. Now I live there." Which I don't find it exactly to be Twin Peaks myself, but it reminds me of my landlady who describes Hudson. She's a expatriate Manhattanite who still, when she walks out the door, seemingly raises her hand and cries for a taxi. "Downtown, please." She calls it Brigadoon on Acid, which is pretty funny, too. There's something of everything here. And even, you know, ethnic groups, there's a multitude of sizable ethnic groups here in Hudson who, by and large, came originally to respond to employment opportunity in a particular industry. And stayed. Bangladeshi community, maybe at number 600, who I think came to work in the button factory, probably. Italians came originally around the turn of the 20th century to work on the railroads. And the brick, I guess that's African Americans, came to work in the brick, the brick making operations, which were abundant in this area because of the clay banks along the river, and Eastern Europeans, I reckon they are, who came directly responding from Europe to for employment in the cement plants, which here were, the one was the largest in the world. And they're still mining the quarries that cover scores of acres, at least, right on the top of town here, which one would never notice, but limestone and the makings of cement. So this was a huge cement place as well. Grit. We have a lot of grit here and a lot of different parts. And you're going to see, really, there's 2 days a year when everybody comes to town. One is Flag Day, which comes up Saturday. And that's a spectacular parade and turnout. And the other is Winter Walk in December, when you'll see a lot of people who don't come to town otherwise. I think a lot of people don't come to town because they don't want, locals who don't want to shop in antique stores. It doesn't really appeal to them. Besides the drugstore and a couple of other places, they probably don't come into town much. But even that slowly changes. There's a Halloween parade for the kids up in the park at 5 o'clock. And I noticed last year, for the hour before that, the antique stores, basically, got together and they had an identifying mark in their store, on their storefront. And they had big bowls of candy, and all the local kids, as they made their way up to the top of the hill to assemble for the Halloween parade, were trick-or-treating in all the antique stores, which was a brilliant idea of integrating parts. And that will only happen more and more in a wide range of ways. One particularly exciting prospect is music is the thing, I think, that really kind of bubbled up from the critical mass that sat waiting for something to take it to the next level. And that's over the last 5 years that music seems to have become a big thing in Hudson. More than anything, perhaps it's musicians who gravitate here and just like it here. That is now starting to have its influence and its effect on the school systems. And here, the Hudson School, which has a dearth of opportunity and funding for arts and for music in particular. They have a waiting list at the middle school, the intermediate school, which does have active band and orchestra programs. That doesn't carry into the high school because of scheduling problems. But even at the intermediate level, they have a list of maybe 45 kids who are waiting for an instrument to be able to play in the orchestra or the band, and they just don't have enough instruments because they really don't have any money. But the as in Chatham, which has a long theatrical influence that it plays into the schools, here in Hudson, one of the exciting prospects is music getting involved, the people who are here and doing music getting involved with this, and affecting the school and that whole slowly elevating that program and those opportunities for those kids. Who largely don't have any opportunity, really, by the time they get to high school to play music. There was huge news just a couple of days ago about the artist Ellsworth Kelly, who I think is around 90 years old and has lived up here for a long time, and enabled some of the initial contact between recording studios and musicians and the school system and the kids who might have an interest. operating in the dark. And it was just a couple of days ago that it was announced that Ellsworth Kelly has donated somewhere, it's like $380,000 or more to the school systems in Columbia County to fund arts-related opportunities. Huge, huge. And that's one of the really exciting things about Hudson is the slowly developing connections between the professionals and the kids, and elevating that experience from both sides. There's a lot of things like that that are in the offing.
So you mentioned that you had moved here from Elizabeth Street. I wonder what your time in New York was like. Tell me about that.
Well, I came to New York in 1979, given the opportunity, and didn't want to pass it up because one never knows if that opportunity comes again. And I arrived on Elizabeth Street, at the corner of Prince, in what was then Little Italy, which was so lively and noisy and fascinating. I found it hard to believe anybody ever had time to go to sleep because you might miss something. After 25 years, it had largely been de-Italianized, and humorless young white people had taken over the neighborhood, and it was irksome to me. And the loss of chaos, I missed the chaos. And I was lucky I got to New York in 1979 because there was still plenty of it. And I wouldn't say the Disneyfication of New York, but the transition of Times Square into an amusement park really was really the harbinger of what was coming. The city looks beautiful. All that money certainly has made all the many buildings look better than they have in a long time, and it's lovely and wonderful. But I just really missed the chaos, and I got to be a grumpy survivor and went further into Chinatown, the only place where untoward things still happen. But even then, I thought, you know, I probably should leave. And luckily, my friends called and said, there's this apartment. I came up on the train, and I thought, wow, this is beyond anything I could have imagined. And the transition was seamless. It was seamless. I couldn't be too close to the city because all I'd think about is how fast can I get back? How long has it been since I was on my beloved Manhattan? But it's just far enough so it's handy, but it's not, you just don't want to hop on the train every day and go to town. And I don't really miss it. I hesitate to say that in public. Because I love New York City, but and I'm glad people still come and are excited and somehow are able to smile despite whatever they have to pay in their rent, which is a telling difference. And it's a lot cheaper living in Hudson City, yeah.
Do you have any particular moments of chaos that you remember that that stick out in your mind, either in Hudson or in New York?
Well, in New York, God, there were plenty. Even in my neighborhood, which was Elizabeth Street, was a pretty bleak couple of blocks between Houston and Spring Street, and in print would be described as, you know, the most lost couple of blocks in New York. And there was a significant mafia presence. So it was as safe as any neighborhood in New York. Occasionally a big gun battle would go off. A car downstairs on the corner outside my window would be attacked by another car, and one night in particular, they jumped out of the car that was chasing. They tore the door off the car at the stop sign there at the corner of Prince Elizabeth, and we're trying to drag the guy out of the car, and he screams off, and they're chasing after him. There was also a vacant lot, and there were two-thirds of the block of between Elizabeth and Mott Street and Prince and Spring was a vacant lot. A school had been there years ago and long gone. And there were young Dominicans. There was a fair amount of Dominican presence in Little Italy at that point, because the old folks were dying and the young people had all moved to the suburbs. Dominican population had been moving in for a while before I came. And there were young Dominican boys, 20, 21, who would often be on the corner of Prince and Elizabeth, just nice-looking fellows, just kind of standing around. It took a while to realize they were working. That was another remarkable night. But in the meantime, in the afternoons, they would go down to the vacant lot and start playing baseball. A game would start with them. And then by 6, 6:30, the 20, 30-year-old young Dominican fellows would come back from work, and that would develop into the main game of the day, the evening affair. And the old men in their fedoras would come out to watch, and that was the big show. But in the warm-up with the younger fellows, I started going down and playing with them, because I'm a baseball player. And one of the most thrilling moments of my entire life, perhaps, was playing center field in the vacant lot, and in pursuit of a fairly towering fly ball, I had to run over an abandoned car over the roof to catch the ball, which I did. There was also a day, there were a lot of drunks and Bowery bums in the neighborhood, because all the buildings between Elizabeth and Bowery were abandoned. There were 20 or 30 drunks who would often be there, especially over the weekends, the ones who came to town to toast it all. And they used the vacant lot as their rally point during the day. And typically they would gather furniture off the sidewalks and bring it into the lot. And there'd be 30 or 40 of them out there. And there was a particularly cold January day. And there, by the end of the weekend, all the furniture would go up in flames. But on Saturday morning, after they had set up with their initial finds, they go off to the bars on the Bowery to get loaded. And one could find nice pieces of furniture if one needed a chair or two. You would find it there. There was a weekend, cold, wind blowing in the middle of winter. And when I came upon them on Saturday afternoon, they had found what looked like props from a little theater production of South Pacific. They had 5-foot sections of rolling main. And they had 15 or 20 pieces, I think, of rolling main with their 30 or 40 chairs, in which they were all seated with a fire. And they had arranged the sections of rolling main as a windbreaker. So all you could see were their heads. And rolling main, it was one of the most surreal, lovely things I ever beheld in that fabulous city. Yeah. Very colorful neighborhood it was. And one never said the word mafia. It was the first thing they told you when you moved in. Don't ever say the word mafia. It was colorful. In those days, there wasn't even air conditioning. So, you know, 80 people would be out on the fire escapes on hot nights in the summer, sleeping. Fabulous, fabulous. But everything changes, and New York is one of those classic examples, I guess. And it was time to go. This was the perfect place, as it turned out, to carry on. Yeah.
Tell me about the friends that were living here before you, and who called you about it.
Well, they were my oldest friends from New York City, who I met the first day I came to town. Actually, I have a photograph of me shaking hands with the one of the two who became a really great friend from the beginning. They moved up here in 1990, and I would come once in a while to visit. They both had One had an antique store in Hudson, and the other had a dress. He made dresses. And they lived out in the country. And we'd always, I'd come up once a year, and we'd come into town and go into their the dress production store or in the antique store. But other than those two stores, Main Street, Warren Street, seemed to have, there wasn't anything. There were no businesses on Warren Street in the early 90s that I could tell. Also, I didn't realize there were any other blocks. I never saw any other streets. We just come up and down Warren Street. There seemed to be a dusty little bodega kind of store and maybe a dusty little junk store and seemingly nothing else. There were other things I learned after I came. There were a few of the old stores that were still hanging on, but they weren't obvious. Also, my friends, my one friend in particular is Timothy Dunleavy, the one I met my first day in New York in 1979. And he started a group called Historic Hudson, which has been devoted to historic preservation, and particularly the Dr. Oliver Bronson House on the grounds of what's now the prison was the girls' training center. And they have been, that's why that house is has been saved and has become to light and awareness to architects who marvel at what they find when they come here. But Timothy's interest was what they call, to my ear, the period, which is Greek Revival in the 1830s. I didn't know the 20th century had ever occurred in Hudson. I'd never heard of the 20th century in Hudson. I thought everything was Greek Revival and just stayed that way. The day I came up to look at the apartment after Timothy had called me to say, "There's this great apartment." I came to look at it. The fellow who was taking care of the house, the agent, as it were, who was not a realtor by any means, but was handling the house. He looks like a drowned river rat, and he was probably in his mid or late 60s. He had started out, as he told me, as the shine boy at the lesbian whorehouse. And there wasn't a whorehouse that catered to lesbians, but there was one, I guess, that seemed to attract lesbians from France. My friend, the agent, ended up with a couple of, he took care of and helped the old madams as they removed to upper floors on Warren Street in their later years. And he ended up with some great artifacts, including a couple of trunks from what he refers to as the lesbian whorehouse. And there were letters in there from the girls after they left, and this one place seemed to attract French girls. And they'd gone back to France, but would write letters to the madam, who they remained close with, about the wonderful years they worked in Hudson for her. This fellow I'm speaking of, in the course of this 5-hour interview about this apartment, which was basically him telling me about the 20th century, I didn't realize had ever occurred here. By the time he was in high school, he had won a barge in a card game and was operating an illegal liquor and gambling thing down on the river. I thought, this is Hudson. This is not the period. This is the 20th century. My friend finally called after 5 hours. He said, "Where are you? What are you doing?" I said, "I've been learning about the 20th century that I didn't know ever happened here." Wow, did it ever. What was your question? What did you ask me?
I had asked you just to tell me about the friends that brought you here.
Oh, yeah.
But we like to follow the thread of
Yeah,
the line
yeah.
of thought, so just keep
Well, I've been ever
telling
grateful.
us.
My friend Timothy, I came to New York because I'd been publishing a little magazine, a little literary magazine, and I needed to do it in a place with much more immediacy to get to a job and a job where I could stay and do my magazine after hours. and move around. Timothy quickly became general counsel, as I appointed him to of my magazine. He's always offered very sage advice, and I have him to thank for my transformation into a Hudsonite 9 summers ago. Yeah. I think I've exhausted my thought.
Well, tell me about where you were before New York.
Well, I grew up in the lovely western suburbs of Philadelphia, a Philadelphia Quaker, and then I went to school in North Carolina, improbably, to this little school where a lot of other curious, funny characters also ended up going to school back in the latter 60s. And I say I grew up outside of Philadelphia, and I woke up in North Carolina. And a college called St. Andrew's College, which was somewhat experimental and new, and quickly developed a literary tradition. I kind of adopted the out-of-business Black Mountain College history and experience, and cultivated that, those people, and celebrated them, and many of them came to St. Andrews, and as I say, quickly established a real deep literary tradition, particularly through the poet in residence, who is still there, emeritus, since 1967, around the time I came too. We started playing a baseball game, and in the spring of 1970, and a cow pasture softball game. We ended up playing, we were the off-campus freaks, and we played amongst ourselves. Occasionally we'd have an exhibition game against the campus kingpin team, which we called the Grits, and they were the inimitable check pants, kind of high-waisted and tassel loafers, but the things were changing in general and spreading around in the dynamic of population, and we got along fine and ended up playing for the city title at the end of the spring. And we came back the next year and did it again, even though we were graduating and moving to other places. We still came back for a week and played baseball, and we kept coming back. And then the locals, who were probably in high school when we were in college, they also played baseball. So they started they invited us to come back to celebrate their harvest, they being the sons of cotton farmers, were moving into and celebrating a different kind of crop in a different kind of time. And three or four teams of the locals became involved. And by 1976, we had also been going up to the mountains in Western Carolina in the summer, where some people had gone off to graduate school and found baseball there. So it became a three-season stop, spring, summer, and fall, in the Western mountains in the summer and out in the sand hills in the fall and at school, back at the school in the spring, and that with 10 teams, and that's what we've been doing in that fully established circuit since 1976, that we just last month started our 44th season. It's an extraordinary dynamic, and I'm sure it's unique. I don't know, I've never heard of any place that produced a game that lasted for more than 5 or, I don't think, even 10 years. There are a couple of odd places. Missoula, Montana is one. There were some real interesting poets who came out, I think, in Missoula back in the 40s, and they had some baseball. But it might have been several years, pretty casually. This has been something truly, I think, unique. And at this point now, there are 100 players at any given weekend. We meet for a weekend and play. Everybody plays four games, and then there's a championship. But of the field of 100 players, more than half are now second generation kids who grew up with their crazy parents coming to these things, and all these kids who know each other through that alone, in large part, and now have taken the positions and are on the field. And the third generation is just about to start playing. There are a couple of 14-year-olds who any time now are going to be taking the field. There'll be a third generation out there. I was the one who kept score from the first day. I'm an inveterate scorekeeper. And I've always done that since I was a little kid. I just love baseball statistics and the numbers. And if I was awake in math class, I was turning, opening and closing the math book, and the page number would transfer into a lifetime history of a pitcher or a batter, you know, all the statistics. That was as much as my interest in math class. So when this thing started, I thought, this is going to be something. So I started keeping score immediately, and I became, as my character, Gifford Rundy, the historian of this game. And I got to where I wanted to tell the stories, so I started the magazine called Rundy's Journal. And at the college, there was, as I said, quickly established a literary tradition, a press, St. Andrew's Review, all of which seemed a little like something a little more casual was called for at this point, because there were enough crazy, interesting characters who probably, that wasn't going to be their venue, but they needed a place. So I started Rundy's to tell the baseball stories and offered the space to anybody else to tell their stories, which is what happened. And it grew out of that. Across the country, somebody would go visit in San Francisco and meet some poet and tell them about this magazine, and the poet would write to me. And many of these people I never met, but they became ardent contributors, and from Seattle to San Francisco to Florida and all over, 30 or 40 people became regular contributors to this magazine, which went on for 17 years. But that was in 1976 that it started. And by 1979, I had moved to Richmond, Virginia, my first city, which I thought I'd stay forever. But it was slow getting around. You know, in public transportation, very slow. And when I was invited to come to New York to do an issue of my magazine in someone I had met's living room, I said, I'll take it. And you know, I never looked back. I was in heaven from the day I walked in the door of that place. And I needed a job, which I found in an office where they take me as I was. I looked a bit like Tarzan, but they were happy to have me, and I was left after hours to stay to do my magazine because I needed their equipment. It was something I did in those days on a typewriter. And while I was always away in April for our season opener in the spring in North Carolina, and never present for the event during National Secretary's Week, which is now, I think, called National Administrative Assistant Week, still celebrated, they would have a contest for the fastest typist in New York City, which I had no doubt I was, but I never got to actually officially be recognized as such. But typing was I was a powerful typist from typesetting Rundy's Journal for hours on end, and found a place that was thrilled to have me. And then when that ended, after a couple of years, I found another one quickly, and there I stayed longer. I outlasted the guys whose name was on the door of the place. And that was how I did all that, and it was marvelous. But there came a time when it was getting a little exhausting, so I had to stop, and because there were other things, other projects I needed to pursue. It was an extraordinary experience. I loved it. People would send it to me, and I'd put it together and pick and choose. Rarely ever had to turn anything down. Everything fit, everything worked, everything was good. And put it together and typed it up and laid it out and pasted it up, and nobody made any money except the printer and the post office. And sometimes that was not an easy achievement in itself between the time I dropped it off and the time I picked it up, but it always happened. And New York was great that way because you could come and live a marginal existence to pursue what your dreams are. And that was the thing I came to miss. I mean, people still come for that, but they have to live in Brooklyn or elsewhere. And that energy in Manhattan has been long missing. And as people died and moved away, and the change, the real estate change after the mid-90s, it became a different kind of a place to someone like me who had been there before. So that's why I left. But like I say, Hudson is a nice, gritty, fascinating step forward. Yeah.
What are some of the changes you've witnessed in Hudson?
Well, when I came most of all because I didn't want to be anywhere where I knew people, because I didn't want to be interrupted. And I'd been frustrated the last several years in New York. I had sold my tenement rights, and so I was, the last 2 years when I should have left, I didn't want to yet, so I moved further into Chinatown, but I was paying market, so it was, all that money I'd gotten paid was going to disappear fast. And I didn't want to go back to Richmond because I have a lot of friends there. And I'm one who, if somebody calls and wants to do something and I say no because I'm going to work, I have work to do, which I always feel like I'm about 3 years behind, then I would feel badly about turning it down so I wouldn't get any work done. So I wouldn't get anywhere there. So Hudson, I thought, well, that would be good. I don't have to have a car. Coming from New York, I hadn't had one. I didn't want one. And it works on a bike, mm-hmm. easily enough. So for the first 4 years, I didn't know many people. If I wanted to go out, I went out in the garden. I hadn't had a garden in 40 years. It was thrilling. It was beautiful. And I got a lot of work done and did those two major, my opus magnus and my magnus opus. And it was glorious. And then, like I say, my life turned completely upside down one day and went downhill from there for the next 8 months. And I had to leave the house, and I had to find a way to make a living suddenly. And that's when the people who probably recognized me, because I would go out every day to a cafe. Have to go out to a cafe to have some objective look at things. And Hudson's always, since I've been here, it's a great place for coffee. It was always a place that worked for me, so I was visible, although I didn't really know many people. I was at best, there goes that guy on his bike, you know, but I don't know who he is. But enough people had seen me sitting and reading for hours at the French cafe and laboring over paper, and I came to know a lot of people when the change came. And so when I came at eight years ago, the place looked about like it does now. And as a friend would say, it had reached critical mass, but it was waiting for something to bubble up and take it to the next, to raise the general energy of the place. And that was the question, you know, what will that be? It soon enough seemed likely that music would be what took it up the notch and brought everything else along with it. And I think that, broadly speaking, is what happened. And it was about 3 years ago, in the spring, 3 years ago, where suddenly it began to be really quite noticeable that people were moving to Hudson. At first it was older people leaving a career behind in New York, and 20-somethings were always abundant, And then after maybe a year and a half into this last 3 years of people visibly arriving and being in the car business, I would notice, new people, and that they would ask and they call me to go shopping or whatever they were going to do. Then young families began to be moving to Hudson. And that was really the last missing piece, I think, of a population is young families. And young families, from that point on, it just, the energy level has just gone up significantly. And things are happening and opening, and we have our own community radio station the last 2 years now, which is huge. And there's a lot of things. There's a lot of things going on here one would never know unless you knew where to look. Reminds me, in a way, of my college, where you can walk around and think, is there anybody here? And there were plenty of things going on, but if you didn't know where to... And I think of this when I see people who obviously are first-time visitors, and they're walking up the street, and they wouldn't know where to go find anything, but there's so many things going on. If you go to a website that, as there are, of things where they post all the things that are happening, they'd be amazed. But... the food court. I'm quite crazy for the food court development. This is, I think, the fifth summer. And it was started by Tortillaville, the Mexican food truck, which for me was a godsend when they arrived. And from May to November, I eat a lot of burritos from Tortillaville. Allison and Brian are the two who actually lived around the corner from me in New York for the same 27 years. I was in Little Italy. They were in Little Italy. And while there are people here who I knew for many years in New York, who I came here and found they had come here also, Brian and Allison I had never seen before. Mm-hmm. Never seen them before. They were interviewed, Brian was interviewed last week in the Times Union, and he was talking about food courts, which he's a big proponent of, and he's just written a book about running a food truck business. It's coming out, I guess, this month. And he was talking about food courts in general, and particularly probably this one, as there's now a wood-fired pizza truck in the back, and it's been there for 2 or 3 years. Run by a guy named Sam, and that's a wonderful place. And there's Indian food, which is a lovely setting. Brian was talking about it's a neighborhood unto itself. There's a community of people that one becomes very familiar with, probably basically at the food court. There's a whole little world that exists and moves through there. And I was quite struck by that thought, because that's really true about that being a regular down there. There's a whole realm of characters that one might not see much of elsewhere, but you run into them. It's a very cool dynamic. Hudson is a city of rather expensive restaurants. There's several things we're missing, and one is reasonable places to eat. I don't know why there aren't more, or why somebody hasn't realized it and done something about it, but the food court down there, Tortillaville, starting it, and Sam's Pizza and the Indian place are a nice start. We don't have a movie theater. We were unlucky, as opposed to a lot of the neighboring little towns, which still have their small theater. And I think it was that the right sized theater wasn't the last one standing. Hudson has a remarkable history of movie theaters, starting in 1904. The first film began to be exhibited in Columbia County, in Hudson, and also in Chatham. Hudson, by Hudson Theater, the Rialto, the Star in 1912, had four movie theaters by 1912, and through almost to the Second War, and even for a couple of years during the war, had four movie theaters on Warren Street. The greatest of them all was the Playhouse, which back in the 30s, the late 20s, was running complete 2.5-hour movie and vaudeville shows for the second shift workers at midnight on a Saturday. But the right one wasn't the last one standing. So when the last theater closed in 1971, it was too big to hang on until, as Catskill and Chatham and Millerton and others had the right size, I guess, to stay in there. So we don't have a movie there, and that's a big void. In particular, besides the lack of reasonable, good places to go eat, and there are some, and there more will come. There's not a movie theater, and it is. One of its main voids is there's really not much for kids. I mean, this must be a great place for a kid to grow up in many ways. But Main Street isn't something they go to particularly because there's nothing really there. There's a CVS, and seemingly that's about it. I mentioned this to a couple of store owners who said, oh, no, no. There's a store called Look up in the 600 block. She sells, one of the places that sells classic vintage clothing. But she's always, since they've been there the last 3 years, I guess, she said, no, she has always has a section of $5-$10 items. And she gets teenage girls who come in shopping, especially at Christmas and other times of the year, too, who are very happy and participate in those opportunities. And that was very cool to hear. So it's a slow process, but there's a, you know, a growing integration and something for more than for kids. And that's one of the things we really are missing is that connection to town. I don't know what kind of town you grew up in. I grew up in a couple of lovely classic suburban towns. And, you know, we had the movie theater, we had everything else, and it was thrilling. It was a real part of the deal to go uptown, right? But you don't see that many kids on Warren Street because they're not going to be buying antiques and or expensive meals, but and there are no hangout joints like there used to be historically, but there that and those things and a movie theater. Someday we'll have a movie theater again. The first two movie operations in Hudson were in the what we now call the Opera House, which was City Hall from the time it was built in 1854 or 5 till it left in 1962 and moved up street. It was the City Hall, but upstairs the auditorium was rented out, and that's where the Elks first in 1903, and then the people involved, the ballplayers involved in the ownership of that minor league Hudson River League team in Hudson that went belly up in 1907 along with the league. They were all in arrears, so they took over the theater upstairs and started showing movies and theatricals, and the movies were a big hit. And by 1912, they built the $75,000 Playhouse Theater, which was the biggest and the greatest show in Hudson of all. How'd I get up there? The Opera House, which was left to the Pigeons, not that long ago, when Gary and the people involved with the Hudson Opera House saved it and have been restoring it, the last great moment is now underway, which is to restore the auditorium upstairs. Which when I first saw it, and one can go down there and they'll invite you to go to the end of the ground floor hall and up to the auditorium to see it. When I went in there to tell them a little bit or ask them about what they were aware of as to the movie history, which started up there, they didn't really know that much about that. But they invited me to go up and have a look, and it was as though someone had closed the door in 1920 and nobody had gone up in 85 years. It was hauntingly spectacular to behold. It's a very expensive restoration, but it is underway. And when that gets done, that's where I think the movies may come back to Hudson, where they started in 1904. And that would be really thrilling. You got to have a movie. You need a movie theater on Main Street. So that's, there's a lot of things. I have a friend who came to town and bought a church, came from New York, bought a church on 6th Street and moved his recording studio there. He's a world-famous producer and recording engineer. And he's been involved for several years in trying to get the music into the school system. It's difficult. There are a few kids who have talent and interest, but they don't have any support. Their families probably don't really encourage them. They may not really have the money to support the effort. Maybe they're a little leery of the New Yorker who's trying to get something going. And there's another fellow, I think his name is Jeff. I won't remember his last name. He spent 35 years in the New York school system. He's been living in Columbia County. And he's been very vital to this whole growing but still young attempt to get the music into the schools, where there's a real dearth of the arts. By the time you get into ninth grade, there just isn't money or time for it. But it's those things, and it's a lot of these things are in the early stages, but I have no doubt that over time these things will just grow and become more and more significant and important. And that's very exciting. Even Maria Abramovic, who I don't know that there are many people in Hudson probably who would be thrilled to go and sit for 6 hours and watch her move slowly across space. But there are people around the world who are going to be clamoring to come to Hudson to behold this dynamic. And to me, that is just, it's an awesome prospect. One of the great things about Hudson is its architecture. There is great representation of every moment of American architectural history here in Hudson. And its poverty is what really saved it over the 20th century. There are a lot of industries in town, at least into the 1960s, maybe even the early 70s. But and everybody had a job and everybody worked, but they didn't really make a lot of money. So there wasn't money to be tearing things down, to remodel. You just covered things up. And that is what saved this remarkable collection of architectural moments. The one thing someone said to me was, well, there's no modern architecture. And I don't suppose there is to speak of in Hudson. There is out in the countryside some moments, but not really in Hudson. But then the next thing you know, Ram Koolhaas is going to be the architect of the Abramovic Center in the old movie theater up at 7th and Columbia. So we will have a great moment in modern architecture, I'm sure. It is, as I just keep saying, a funny, odd, improbable phenomenon that really took off in the wake of the economic collapse. Not to me, it's surprising, I suppose, but that's when it really began to accelerate. And there are a lot of characters, local and imports, who inhabit this place, I must say. Yeah.
Well, that was great. I think that's exactly, that's a nice
perfect.
Point.
Oh,
yeah.
Good.
That was awesome.
We covered everything, I reckon, that I could possibly imagine.
Yeah.
Good. Okay.
Great. I really enjoyed that.
What was that? An hour at least, right?
Yeah, that was an hour and 4 minutes.
Wow. Ideal.
Yeah.
Cool.
Cool.